If you had nothing to think about but yourself for days, what would you find out about yourself? Does the person you think you are reconcile with the person the world sees? Do we have the courage to face the truths about ourselves and realize the little lies we tell ourselves every day? This is not a meditation exercise, don't worry. This is Agatha Christie's book, Absent in the Spring, written under her nom de plume, Mary Westmacott. We all know Agatha Christie as the queen of crime, who has given us Hercule Poirot, Miss Marple, and the longest-running stage play in history, The Mousetrap. But she also wrote about the crimes of the heart, bittersweet stories with a jagged edge, and a deep understanding of human nature. Of this book, Agatha Christie stated that it was the one book that has satisfied me completely, the book I always wanted to write. Apparently, she finished writing this book in 3 days. I read this book a few years ago and it really affected me for days. It left me with a sense of unease, self-reflection, a bit of dread, feeling uncomfortable and emotionally bulldozered, but all in a good way. And it speaks to the strength of Agatha Christie's writing that a book, a story, can affect you so. I remember calling up my sister who had given me this book and telling her, "What the hell did you give me? Did you also read this book and did you also feel as emotionally moved as I did?" And she was like, "Yes." And the next thing we spoke about is, "Do you know someone who's like the woman in this book?" And then the next question is, "Shit, am I like the woman in this book?" So you see, that is why I love this book. It really talks about things that we do as humans, like human nature, that we don't acknowledge as everyday conversation, obviously, because it's uncomfortable. Nobody wants to hear these truths about yourself. All of us have these doubts. All of us have these moments where we look back and we ask ourselves, what kind of a person are we? Are we the same person we are on the inside as we are on the outside? You know, do we even know half the time the stories we spin about ourselves to ourselves in order to have that picture of yourself as a person, like this is me. But how well do you know yourself and is that really you? These are the kind of things that come up when you read this book and it's just brilliant. So stick with me and let's get on with this beautiful story. Absent in the Spring by Agatha Christie. Chapter 1. Joan Scudamore screwed up her eyes as she peered across the dimness of the rest house dining room. She was slightly short-sighted. Surely that's... No, it isn't. I believe it is. Blanche Haggard. Extraordinary. Right out in the wilds. To come across an old school friend whom she hadn't seen for, oh, quite 15 years. At first, Joan was delighted by the discovery. She was by nature a sociable woman, always pleased to run across friends and acquaintances. She thought to herself, but poor dear, how dreadfully she's changed. She looks years older, literally years. After all, she can't be more than, what, 48? It was a natural sequence after that to glance at her own appearance in the mirror that happened most conveniently to hang just beside the table. What she saw there put her in an even better humor. Really, thought Joan Scudamore, I've worn very well. She saw a slender, middle-aged woman with a singularly unlined face, brown hair hardly touched with grey, pleasant blue eyes, and a cheerful, smiling mouth. The woman was dressed in a neat, cool travelling coat and skirt and carried a rather large bag containing the necessities of travel. Joan Scudamore was travelling back from Baghdad to London by the overland route. She had come up by the train from Baghdad last night. She was to sleep in the railway rest house tonight and go on by car tomorrow morning. It was the sudden illness of her younger daughter that had brought her post-haste out from England, her realization of Williams, her son-in-law, impracticability, and of the chaos that would arise in a household without efficient control. Well, that was all right now. She had taken charge, made arrangements. The baby, William, Barbara Convalescent, everything had been planned and set in good running order. Thank goodness, thought Joan, I've always had a head over my shoulders. William and Barbara had been full of gratitude. They'd pressed her to stay on, not to rush back, but she had smilingly, albeit with a stifled sigh, refused, for there was Rodney to consider. Poor old Rodney, stuck in Creamminster, up to his ears in work and with no one in the house to look after his comfort except servants. And after all, said Joan, what are servants? Barbara said, your servants, mother, are always perfection. You see to that. She had laughed, but she had been pleased all the same. Because when all was said and done, one did like appreciation. She had sometimes wondered if her family took a little too much for granted the smooth running of the house and her own care and devotion. Not really that she had any criticism to make. Tony, Avril, and Barbara were delightful children, and she and Rodney had every reason to be proud of their upbringing and of their success in life. Tony was growing oranges out in Rhodesia. Avril, after giving her parents some momentary anxiety, had settled down as the wife of a wealthy and charming stockbroker. Barbara's husband had a good job in the public works department in Iraq. They were all nice-looking, healthy children with pleasant manners. Joan felt that she and Rodney were indeed fortunate, and privately she was of the opinion that some of the credit was to be ascribed to them as parents. After all, they had brought the children up very carefully, taking infinite pains over the choice of nurses and governesses, and later, of schools, and always putting the welfare and well-being of the children first. Joan felt a little gentle glow as she turned away from her image in the glass. She thought, well, it's nice to feel one's been a success at one's job. I never wanted a career or anything of that kind. I was quite content to be a wife and mother. I married the man I loved, and he's been a success at his job, and perhaps that's owing to me a bit too. One can do so much by influence. Dear Rodney. And a heart warmed to the thought that soon, very soon, she would be seeing Rodney again. She'd never been away from him for very long before. What a happy, peaceful life they had had together. Well, perhaps peaceful was rather overstating it. Family life was never quite peaceful. Holidays, infectious illnesses, broken pipes in winter. Life really was a series of petty dramas, and Rodney had always worked very hard, harder perhaps than was good for his health. He'd been badly run down that time 6 years ago. He hadn't, Joan thought with compunction, worn quite as well as she had. He stooped rather, and there was a lot of white in his hair. He had a tired look too, about the eyes. Still, after all, that was life, and now, with the children married and the firm doing so well, and the new partner bringing fresh money in, Rodney could take things more easily. He and she would have time to enjoy themselves. They must entertain more, have a week or two in London every now and then. Rodney, perhaps, might take up golf. Yes, really, she couldn't think why she hadn't persuaded him to take up golf before. So healthy, especially when he had to do so much office work. Having settled that point in her mind, Mrs. Scudamore looked across the dining room once more at the woman whom she believed to be her former school friend, Blanche Haggard. How she had adored Blanche Haggard when they were at St. Anne's together! Everyone was crazy about Blanche. She had been so daring, so amusing, and yes, so absolutely lovely. Funny to think of that now, looking at that thin, restless, untidy elderly woman. What extraordinary clothes! And she looked, really, she looked at least 60. Of course, thought Jim, she's had a very unfortunate life. A momentary impatience rose in her. The whole thing seemed such a wanton waste. There was Blanche, 21, with the world at her feet, looks, position, everything. And she had had to throw in a lot with that quite unspeakable man. A vet. Yes, actually a vet. A vet with a wife, too, which made it worse. Her people had behaved with commendable firmness, taking her around the world on one of those pleasure cruises, and Blanche had actually got off the boat somewhere, Algiers or Naples, and come home and joined her vet. And naturally, he had lost his practice and started drinking, and his wife hadn't wished to divorce him. Presently, they'd left Creamminster, and after that, Joan hadn't heard anything of Blanche for years. Not until she'd run across her one day in London at Harrods, where they had met in the shoe department, and after a little discreet conversation, discreet on Joan's part, Blanche had never set any store by discretion. She had discovered that Blanche was now married to a man called Holiday, who was in an insurance office, but Blanche thought he was going to resign soon because he wanted to write a book about Warren Hastings, and he wanted to give all his time to it, not just write scraps when he came back from the office. Joan had murmured that in that case she supposed he had private means, and Blanche had replied cheerfully that he hadn't got a cent. Joan had said that perhaps to give up his job would be rather unwise, unless he was sure the book would be a success. Was it commissioned? Oh, dear me, no, said Blanche cheerfully, and as a matter of fact, she didn't really think the book would be a success, because though Tom was very keen on it, he really didn't write very well. Whereupon, Joan had said with some warmth that Blanche must put a foot down, to which Blanche had responded with a stare and a, "But he wants to write, the poor pet. He wants it more than anything." Sometimes, Joan said, one had to be wise for two. Blanche had laughed and remarked that she herself had never even been wise enough for one. Thinking that over, Joan felt that it was only too unfortunately true. A year later, she saw Blanche in a restaurant with a peculiar, flashy-looking woman and two flamboyantly artistic men. After that, the only reminder she had had of Blanche's existence was 5 years later when Blanche wrote and asked for a loan of £50. Her little boy, she said, needed an operation. Joan had sent her 25 and a kind letter asking for details. The response was a postcard with scrawled on it, "Good for you, Joan. I knew you wouldn't let me down," which was gratifying in a way, but hardly satisfactory. After that, silence. And now here, in a near eastern railway rest house, with kerosene lamps flaring and spluttering amidst the smell of rancid mutton fat and paraffin and flit, was the friend of so many years ago, incredibly aged and coarsened and the worse for wear. Blanche finished her dinner first and was on her way out when she caught sight of the other. She stopped dead. "Holy Moses, it's Joan!" A moment or two later, she had pulled up a chair to the table and the two were chatting together. Presently, Blanche said, "Well, you've worn well, my dear. You look about 30. Where have you been all these years? In cold storage?"
"Hardly that. I've been in Creamminster."
"Born, bred, married, and buried in Creamminster," said Blanche. Joan said with a laugh,
"Is that so bad a fate?"
Blanche shook her head. "No," she said seriously.
I'd say it was a pretty good one. What's happened to your children? You had some children, didn't you?
Yes, three. A boy and two girls. The boy is in Rhodesia. The girls are married. One lives in London. I've just been visiting the other one out in Baghdad. Her name is Ray, Barbara Ray.
Blanche nodded. I've seen her. Nice kid. Married rather too young, didn't she?
I don't think so, said Joan stiffly.
We all like William very much, and they are happy together.
Yes,
they seem to be settling down all right now. The baby has probably been a settling influence. Having a child does sort of steady a girl down.
Not, added Blanche thoughtfully, that it ever steadied me.
I was very fond of those two kids of mine, Len and Mary. And yet, when Johnny Pelham came along, I went off with him and left them behind without a second thought.
Joan looked at her with disapprobation. Really, Blanche? She said warmly. How could you?
Rotten of me, wasn't it? Said Blanche.
Of course, I knew they'd be all right with Tom. He always adored them.
He married a really nice domestic girl. Suited him far better than I ever did. She saw that he had decent meals and mended his underclothes and all that. Dear Tom, he was always a pet. He used to send me a card at Christmas and Easter for years afterwards, which was nice of him, don't you think?
Joan did not answer. She was too full of conflicting thoughts. The predominant one was wonder that this could be Blanche Haggard, that well-bred, high-spirited girl who had been the star pupil at St. Anne's. This really slatternly woman, with apparently no shame in revealing the most sordid details of her life, and in such common language too. Why, Blanche Haggard had won the prize for English at St. Anne's.
Blanche reverted to a former topic. Fancy little Barbara Ray being your daughter, Joan.
That just shows how people get things wrong.
Everyone had got it into their heads that she was so unhappy at home that she'd married the first man who asked her in order to escape.
How ridiculous! Where do these stories come from?
I can't imagine. Because I'm pretty sure of one thing, Joan, and that is that you've always been an admirable mother. I can't imagine you being cross or unkind.
That's nice of you, Blanche. I think I may say that we've always given our children a very happy home and done everything possible for their happiness. I think it's so important, you know, that one should be friends with one's children.
Very nice, if one ever can.
Oh, I think you can. It's just a question of remembering your own youth and putting yourself in their place.
Joan's charming, serious face was bent a little nearer to that of a former friend.
Rodney and I have always tried to do that.
Rodney? Let me see. You married a solicitor, didn't you?
Of course. I went to the firm at the time when Harry was trying to get a divorce from that awful wife of his.
I believe it was your husband we saw. Rodney Scudamore.
He was extraordinarily nice and kind, most understanding.
And you've stayed put with him all these years? No fresh deals?
Joan said rather stiffly. Neither of us have wanted a fresh deal. Rodney and I have been perfectly contented with each other.
Of course. You always were a cold fish, Joan. But I should have said that husband of yours had quite a roving eye.
Really, Blanche?
Joan flushed angrily. A roving eye indeed. Rodney? And suddenly, discordantly, a thought slipped and flashed sideways across the panorama of Joan's mind, much as she had noticed a snake flash and slip across the dust-colored track in front of the car only yesterday, a mere streak of writhing green. Gone almost before you saw it. The streak consisted of three words leaping out of space and back into oblivion. The Randolph girl. gone again before she had time to note them consciously. Blanche was cheerfully contrite. "Sorry, Joan. Let's come into the other room and have coffee. I always did have a vulgar mind, you know." "Oh, no." The protest came quickly to Joan's lips, genuine and slightly shocked. Blanche looked amused. "Oh, yes. Don't you remember? Remember the time I slipped out to meet the baker's boy?" Joan winced. She had forgotten that incident. At the time it had seemed daring and, yes, actually romantic. Really, a vulgar and unpleasant episode. Blanche, settling herself in a wicker chair and calling to the boy to bring coffee, laughed to herself. "Horrid, precocious little piece I must have been. Oh, well, that's always been my undoing. I've always been far too fond of men, and always rotters. Extraordinary, isn't it? First Harry, and he was a bad lot all right, though frightfully good-looking, and then Tom, who never amounted to much. Though I was fond of him, in a way. Johnny Pelham, that was a good time while it lasted. Gerald wasn't much good either." At this point, the boy brought the coffee, thus interrupting what Joan could not but feel was a singularly unsavory catalogue. Blanche caught sight of her expression. "Sorry, Joan, I've shocked you. Always a bit straight-laced, weren't you?" "Oh, I hope I'm always ready to take a broad-minded view." Joan achieved a kindly smile. She added rather awkwardly, "I only mean I'm so sorry." "For me?" Blanche seemed amused by the idea. "Nice of you, darling, but don't waste sympathy. I've had lots of fun." Joan could not resist a swift sideways glance. Really? Had Blanche any idea of the deplorable appearance she presented? Her carelessly dyed henna'd hair, her somewhat dirty, flamboyant clothes, her haggard, lined face. An old woman. An old, raddled woman. An old, disreputable gypsy of a woman. Blanche, her face suddenly growing grave, said soberly, "Yes, you're right, Joan. You've made a success of your life. And I, well, I've made a mess of mine. I've gone down in the world, and you've gone... No, you've stayed where you are. A St. Anne's girl who's married suitably and always been a credit to the old school." Trying to steer the conversation towards the only ground that she and Blanche had in common now, Joan said, "Those were good days, weren't they?" So-so. Blanche was careless in her praise. "I got bored sometimes. It was all so smug and consciously healthy. I wanted to get out and see the world." "Well," her mouth gave a humorous twist, "I've seen it. I'll say I've seen it." For the first time, Joan approached the subject of Blanche's presence in the rest house. "Are you going back to England? Are you leaving on the convoy tomorrow morning?" Her heart sank just a little as she put the question. Really, she did not want Blanche as a travelling companion. A chance meeting was all very well, but she had grave doubts of being able to sustain the pose of friendship all the way across Europe. Reminiscences of the old days would soon wear thin. Blanche grinned at her. "No, I'm going the other way, to Baghdad, to join my husband." "Your husband?" Joan really felt quite surprised that Blanche should have anything so respectable as a husband. "Yes, he's an engineer on the railway. Donovan, his name is."
"Donovan?"
Joan shook her head. "I don't think I came across him at all." Blanche laughed. "You wouldn't, darling. Rather out of your class. He drinks like a fish, anyway. But he's got a heart like a child. And it may surprise you, but he thinks the world of me."
"So he ought," said Joan loyally and politely.
"Good old Joan. Always play the game, don't you?"
You must be thankful I'm not going the other way. It would break you in your Christian spirit to have 5 days of my company. You needn't trouble to deny it. I know what I've become, coarse in mind and body. That's what you were thinking. Well, there are worse things.
Joan privately doubted very much whether there were. It seemed to her that Blanche's decadence was a tragedy of the first water. Blanche went on.
Hope you have a good journey, but I rather doubt it. Looks to me as though the rains are starting. If so, you may be stuck for days, miles from anywhere.
I hope not. It will upset all my train reservations.
Oh, well, desert travel is seldom according to schedule. So long as you get across the wadis all right, the rest will be easy. And of course, the drivers take plenty of food and water along. Still, it gets a bit boring to be stuck somewhere with nothing to do but think.
Joan smiled. It might be rather a pleasant change, you know. One never has time as a rule to relax at all. I've often wished I could have just 1 week with really nothing to do.
I should have thought you could have had that whenever you liked.
Oh, no, my dear. I'm a very busy woman in my small way. I'm the secretary of the Country Gardens Association, and I'm on the committee of our local hospital, and there's the institute and the guides, and I take quite an active part in politics. What with all that and running the house, and then Rodney and I go out a good deal and have people in to see us. It's so good for a lawyer to have plenty of social background, I always think. And then I'm very fond of my garden and like to do quite a good deal in it myself. Do you know, Blanche, that there's hardly a moment, except perhaps a quarter of an hour before dinner, when I can really sit down and rest. And to keep up with one's reading is quite a task.
You seem to stand up to it all pretty well, murmured Blanche, her eyes on the other's unlined face.
Well, to wear out is better than to rust out. And I must admit I've always had marvellous health. I really am thankful for that. But all the same, it would be wonderful to feel that one had a whole day or even 2 days with nothing to do but think.
I wonder, said Blanche, what you think about.
Joan laughed. It was a pleasant, tinkling little sound. There are always plenty of things to think about, aren't there? She said. Blanche grinned.
One can always think of one's sins.
Yes, indeed. Joan assented politely, though without amusement. Blanche eyed her keenly.
Only that wouldn't give you occupation long.
She frowned and went on abruptly.
You'd have to go on from them to think of your good deeds and all the blessings of your life. I don't know. Might be rather dull, I wonder.
She paused. If you've nothing to think about but yourself for days and days, I wonder what you'd find out about yourself.
Joan looked skeptical and faintly amused.
Would one find out anything one didn't know before? Blanche said slowly. I think one might. She gave a sudden shiver. I shouldn't like to try it. Of course, said Joan. Some people have an urge towards the contemplative life. I've never been able to understand that myself. The mystic point of view is very difficult to appreciate. I'm afraid I haven't got that kind of religious temperament. It always seems to me to be rather extreme, if you know what I mean.
It's certainly simpler, said Blanche, to make use of the shortest prayer that is known.
And in answer to Joan's inquiring glance, she said abruptly, God be merciful to me, a sinner.
That covers pretty well everything.
Joan felt slightly embarrassed. Yes, she said. Yes, it certainly does.
Blanche burst out laughing. The trouble with you, Joan, is that you're not a sinner. That cuts you off from prayer. Now I'm well equipped. It seems to me sometimes that I've never ceased doing the things that I ought not to have done.
Joan was silent because she didn't know quite what to say. Blanche resumed again in a lighter tone.
Oh, well, that's the way of the world. You quit when you ought to stick, and you take on a thing that you'd better leave alone. One minute, life's so lovely you can hardly believe it's true, and immediately after that, you're going through a hell of misery and suffering. When things are going well, you think they'll last forever, and they never do. And when you're down under, you think you'll never come up and breathe again. That's what life is, isn't it?
It was so entirely alien to any conception Joan had of life, or to life as she had known it, that she was unable to make what she felt would be an adequate response. With a brusque moment, Blanche rose to her feet.
You're half asleep, Joan.
So am I. And we've got an early start.
It's been nice seeing you.
The two women stood a minute, their hands clasped. Blanche said quickly and awkwardly, with a sudden rough tenderness in her voice,
Don't worry about your Barbara. She'll be all right. I'm sure of it. Bill Ray is a good sort, you know, and there's the kid and everything. It was just that she was very young, and the kind of life out here, well, it goes to a girl's head sometime.
Joan was conscious of nothing but complete bewilderment. She said sharply,
I don't know what you mean.
Blanche merely looked at her admiringly.
That's the good old school tie spirit. Never admit anything.
You really haven't changed a bit, Joan.
By the way, I owe you £25.
Never thought of it until this minute.
Oh, don't bother about that.
No fear, Blanche laughed. I suppose I meant to pay it back, but after all, if one ever does lend money to people, one knows quite well one will never see one's money again. So I haven't worried much.
You were a good sport, Joan. That money was a godsend.
One of the children had to have an operation, didn't he?
So they thought. But it turned out not to be necessary after all. So we spent the money on a bender and got a roll-top desk for Tom as well. He'd had his eye on it for a long time.
Moved by a sudden memory, Joan asked,
Did he ever write his book on Warren Hastings?
Blanche beamed at her.
Fancy your remembering that.
Yes, indeed, 120,000 words.
Was it published?
Oh, of course not. After that, Tom started on the life of Benjamin Franklin. That was even worse. Funny taste, wasn't it? I mean, such dull people. If I wrote a life, it would be of someone like Cleopatra, some sexy piece. Or Casanova, say, something spicy. Still, we can't all have the same ideas. Tom got a job again in an office, not so good as the other. I'm always glad, though, that he had his fun. It's awfully important, don't you think, for people to do what they really want to do?
It rather depends, said Joan, on circumstances. One has to take so many things into consideration.
Haven't you done what you wanted to do?
I?
Joan was taken aback.
Yes, you,
Blanche said. You wanted to marry Rodney Scudamore, didn't you? And you wanted children and a comfortable home? She laughed and added, and to live happily ever afterwards, world without end, amen.
Joan laughed too, relieved at the lighter tone the conversation had taken.
Don't be ridiculous. I've been very lucky, I know. And then, afraid that that last remark had been tactless when confronted by the ruin and bad luck that had been Blanche's lot in life, she added hurriedly,
I really must go up now. Good night, and it's been marvelous seeing you again.
She squeezed Blanche's hand warmly. Would Blanche expect her to kiss her? Surely not. And ran lightly up the stairs to her bedroom. Poor Blanche, thought Joan as she undressed, neatly laying and folding her clothes, putting out a fresh pair of stockings for the morning. Poor Blanche. It's really too tragic.
She slipped into her pajamas and started to brush her hair. Poor Blanche, looking so awful and so coarse. She was ready for bed now, but paused irresolutely before getting in. One didn't, of course, say one's prayers every night. In fact, it was quite a long time since Joan had said a prayer of any kind, and she didn't even go to church very often. But one, of course, did believe. And she had a sudden, odd desire to kneel down now by the side of this rather uncomfortable-looking bed, such nasty cotton sheets. Thank goodness she had got her own soft pillow with her, and, well, say them properly, like a child. The thought made her feel rather shy and uncomfortable. She got quickly into bed and pulled up the covers. She picked up the book that she had laid on the little table by the bedhead, The Memoirs of Lady Catherine Dysart. Really most entertainingly written, a very witty account of mid-Victorian times. She read a line or two, but found she could not concentrate. I'm too tired, she thought. She laid down the book and switched off the light. Again, the thought of prayer came to her. What was it that Blanche had said so outrageously? That cuts you off from prayer. Really, what did she mean? Joan formed a prayer quickly in her mind, a prayer of isolated words strung together. God, thank thee. Poor Blanche, thank thee that I am not like that. Great mercies. All my blessings, and especially not like poor Blanche. Poor Blanche, really dreadful. Her own fault, of course. Dreadful. Quite a shock. Thank God, I am different. Poor Blanche. Joan fell asleep.